You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM Accra, hands-on community radio for Greene and Columbia counties.
You see Lion, the king of beasts.
Music from elsewhere and beyond.
Huge elephant trumpet across the plains.
Imaginary soundtracks to unmade foreign films.
And there are rhino, those craggy creatures surviving from a bygone age.
Snack Point Charlie. Hosted by Jeff Economy. Every first Wednesday from 10 p.m. to midnight on WGXC 90.7 FM. WGXC.org.
Wave Farm programs are made possible in part by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of Governor Andrew Cuomo and the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program administered by CREATE, the Alexander and Marjorie Hoover Foundation, the T. Backer Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors, including WGXE sustaining supporters who provide critical monthly support. Thank you.
WGXE is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Alex Benson of Tivoli, New York. WGXE's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about Creative Community Radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXE as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Give me liberty or give me death.
WGXC, the station that gives you liberty.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Bay Area longtime socialist activist Jeff Mackler, who says that as between the Republican and Democratic Party, we are headed to a disaster, that we need our own independent political party.
We turn yet again to the ongoing judicial misconduct in the case of environmental lawyer Stephen Donziger. Two judges in New York, aided by a powerful law firm that has represented the oil industry, continue their litany of unscrupulous attacks on this human rights attorney. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
We have an editorial from attorney Jim Lafferty, who has a weekly show on our sister station, KPFK in Los Angeles. It's called The Lawyers Guild Show. Jim is a former executive director of the National Lawyers Guild and the past president of the Los Angeles chapter, the largest in the country. He's on the board of the Southern California American Civil Liberties Union. Let's hear from Jim.
You do not hear much about it these days. It is not considered a big enough story to break through all the Trump and pandemic-generated news. Fred, I'm talking about the plight of the world's children and of America's children. I'm talking about the millions of children who die every year for want of food or medicine readily available to the rest of us, or for lack of a roof over their heads, who die, in short, because they are denied the basics needed to survive in this world, includes survive right here in America. At last count, over 2.2 billion impoverished children are clinging to life in the developing countries, and millions of them die every year. At least a staggering 12 million poor children live right here in the United States. Fully one half of them live in quote-unquote extreme poverty, and nearly 73% of these poor children are, not surprisingly, kids of color. There are over 1.5 million homeless kids in the United States, and a whole lot more when school is out. And the numbers are sure to grow unless the unexpected occurs and the federal eviction freeze scheduled to end on December 31st is extended. There is, in fact, a higher percentage of children living in poverty in America than any other American age group. Now, whenever I think of the sad plight of so many children in the world and in the U.S., it brings me to tears of sadness, but also tears of rage. I mean, of course, I care as well about the millions of adult Americans living in poverty, living on the streets, living without adequate food and medicine. It is all unforgivable. But the children, surely their plight is the most unforgivable of all. And what makes it all so unbearably sad and shameful is how easily it could be avoided, how possible it would be to end this horrific reality, how little money and willpower is needed to do the right thing. Now, Biden will be our next president. I do not doubt but what he cares, far more than Trump did, about the plight of America's children. But I have no confidence that America's children will be much better off under Biden than they have been under Trump, or for that matter, than they were under Obama. Why? Well, not simply because the Republicans will control the U.S. Senate. No. The miserable lives and deaths visited upon America's children are quite simply a consequence of our capitalist economic system itself, a system that both parties worship. Oh, Biden will not likely make children's lives worse, as Trump has done. But many far more liberal capitalist administrations than Biden's have, as they left office, left America's children still hungry, still malnourished, still dying of preventable diseases, and still homeless and sleeping on the streets. In the famed novel, The Brothers Karamazov, one brother, Ivan, while arguing with his clergy brother, Alyosha, about God, and pointing out the unforgivable suffering of the world's children, tells Alyosha that he wants no part of such a world and, quote-unquote, respectfully returns God's ticket. Well, like Ivan, I too reject such a world. But unlike Ivan, I'm an atheist, and unlike Ivan, I know the fault does not lie in our stars or with some god, it lies with us. And also, unlike Ivan, we simply cannot give back our ticket and give up. As the Pink Floyd song says, we can't keep turning away from the weak and the weary. In America today, the battle lines have been drawn between those who care only about their own well-being and those of us who claim to represent the opposite of such selfishness. But if we're going to win this battle and turn this horrifically and sad situation around, then we have to clearly fight much harder and smarter than we have so far. And what we fight for must go beyond the limited liberal vision of human rights that is dominant in the world today. We must go beyond merely demanding the abstract equality of rights to demanding, at the very least, a greatly increased equality of the pocketbook. After all, what good is it to have an equal right to housing if you can't afford it and the government does not provide it for you? For that matter, we must demand much more than simply providing children and all of us with a minimal roof over our heads and with stomachs that are only half full. We must demand nothing less than that all children be fed a full and proper diet and be housed in fully adequate housing. And we must demand that poor children receive the same caliber of education as the well-off receive and the promise of a good, non-alienating job as an adult so that the now unconscionable gap between rich and poor can, once and forever, we would hope, be closed. But time is running out on bringing about the fundamental political changes essential to ending capitalism's barbarous infliction of suffering on our children and on, oh, so many others. Surely any honest person, or at least any honest liberal and caring person, must admit that only some form of a socialist economy has any hope of meeting these just demands, at the minimum, such as exists perhaps in a democratic socialist country such as Denmark or Norway. Indeed, it is, in fact, long past time for the ever-growing ranks of we Americans who say we believe in a socialist economy to finally get ourselves better organized into the massive, broad-based, and united socialist revolutionary movement that's going to be essential if we are to eventually save the children and save this country. Now, I have no illusions. It will be hard as hell to win this battle. Yes, it will be a hard, hard fight. But things change, and history itself is on our side. On our side and assuring us that this fight can be won. Besides, what other meaningful choice do we have? Because, friends, at long last, and in the name of our children, can we do less and still claim to be a moral and decent people?
The year 2020 will be seen historically as a monumental one, a turning point in American history. The summer saw mobilizations of tens of millions of people, white and black, mostly young, from small towns and large cities, under black leadership and under the banner of Black Lives Matter. This tremendous mobilization was a reaction to the systemic racism and gross inequality that exists in the USA. These manifestations were followed by the defeat of the cruel racist billionaire demagogue Donald Trump by 6 million votes in the fall election. All the institutions of the ruling elite collaborated to bring about Trump's defeat. The mainstream media, the CIA, the FBI, renegade Republicans, and 131 billionaires all supported Joseph Biden. Only a tiny number of people refused to support either party candidate. Most of the progressive movement was swept back into the Democratic Party, seeing it as the lesser of two evils and hoping that change could be wrought from the inside. Will it? Where does social change come from? Historically, the Democratic Party has been the graveyard of social movements. Will this continue to be the case? After he won, Biden posted a brag that, quote, "I'm the guy that ran against the socialist, okay? I'm the guy that's the moderate." We speak today with longtime California Bay Area socialist activist Jeff Mackler. He recently authorized a manifesto for our times, the challenge to abolish systemic racism. He's the chair of the Mobilization to Free Mumia Abu-Jamal and active in the defense of Julian Assange. He's the founder of the United National Anti-War Coalition, UNAC, and the National Secretary of Socialist Action. He was that group's 2020 candidate for the U.S. presidency. Jeff Mackler, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
I'm glad to be with you.
Jeff, how do you appreciate the anti-racist mobilizations of the past summer?
Well, I'll tell you, I was extremely optimistic. An estimated 16 to 21 million people came out into the streets. A huge number of them were young white people who stood side by side with their black and brown and Native American sisters and brothers. This was truly the largest demonstrations that I have experienced in one lifetime of political activity. However, I was concerned, because I understood that there was going to be a massive effort to turn this fantastic movement into electoral politics, and that is into the campaign of Joe Biden and the Democratic Party. That's the reason why we promulgated this manifesto, that we got a lot of fine people to sign, including Mumia Abu-Jamal and Alice Walker and Glenn Ford. The basic idea was to keep the movement in the streets and independent. And I think, tragically, what we saw in the election was it was none of that. The overwhelming majority of the, quote, leaders of the Black Lives Matter movement, and them talking about the institutional movement for black lives, turned the movement directly into the Democratic Party through the Al Sharpton March in Washington, D.C., and then the National Black Convention, a massive online hookup, and other activities that made it clear that there was really very little in the way of an independently organized black movement for struggle.
Why do you believe that racism in the USA is systemic?
Well, I tell you, if you made that argument before 21 million people went into the streets, you'd have a serious argument on your hands. But when you see that 21 million people said this society is inherently racist, in regard to not just police brutality that averages one, two, if not three, murders of unarmed black and Latino people every single day, but in regard to unemployment, in regard to the number of people who are afflicted with the pandemic, triple the number of blacks. When you count the figures for unemployment, when you count the figures for absence of health care, when you count the figures for jobs, quality of jobs, the type of jobs, in every measure, the poorest people, mostly black and Latinx, Native Americans, are on the bottom of the scale. But that was made even clearer with regard to a simple issue like the statues. Here you had in the halls of Congress pictures of open portraits of open racists. Here you had remembrances that the days of old when the slave patrols rounded up blacks, they have their parallel in today's cops who systematically murder, shoot, imprison black people. Today, the United States ranks number one in the world in regard to the number and percentage of its people in prison. This prison-industrial complex, this school-to-prison scenario, includes sheep herding or herding the poorest of the poor, mostly black and Latinx, from our inferior, segregated, increasingly privatized schools into a prison-industrial complex where poor people are put to work at an average of 50 cents an hour, slave wages indeed. And you have a total of some 5 million people subject to that system. So it's not hard to make the argument that on every front, the continuity with the slave system, with the Jim Crow South, with the segregation system, with the school-to-prison scenario system is fully operative in the United States today.
Martin Luther King famously said, since we know that the system will not change the rules, we're going to have to change the system. Having a choice only between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party is baked into this system. What do you say about this massive movement supporting and rallying to get rid of Trump? What was wrong with that? Why do you think the Democratic Party is a tremendous obstacle to social progress?
Well, in truth, and it's becoming known today, the Democratic Party is the party of the former Southern slavocracy. You know, I'm an 80-year-old fellow. When in my youth, we used to look at the Democratic Party, it was a combination of Northern liberals like JFK and Southern racist bigots. That is, the openly segregationist Strom Thurmond, Eastland, Faubus, these are senators from the South who are openly racist bigots. It was a combination. In fact, that's what Kennedy Johnson was in 1964. Johnson was the VP candidate to rein in the votes of the Southern slavocracy. He owned land that had codicils in it, disallowing its sale for blacks. When the Democratic Party decided, under mass pressure of the civil rights movement, to make some concessions, they lost the Southern racist bigots openly to the Northern Republicans, the Nixon strategy. That's the reason why the Democrats had to run a bunch of Southerners, like former segregationist Jimmy Carter from Georgia, or Al Gore from, where was he from, Tennessee or Arkansas, or even Bill Clinton. They needed the ring of the former Southern segregationists to pick up a couple of electoral votes to win the presidency. Biden's role historically has been the Southern racist bigot Delaware component of the Democratic Party. His job was to organize the Southern racists into the, quote, Northern Liberal Democratic Party, that is, to align the South with the North. And in order to do that, they had to make concessions to the Southern racist bigots, which Biden was expert at. Biden's crime bills opened the door to the mass incarceration that we see today. Biden, in his youth, backed school segregation. Back to Strom Thurmond's, gave eulogies at their funerals. He was the man that the Democrats needed to keep the solid South in line. That hasn't fundamentally changed today. The Democrats have multiple strategies, including electing a black man like Barack Obama, who they posed as a, quote, northern liberal. But it was Obama and his administration, nicknamed the Great Deporter, who sent 2,000 people, if not 3 million people, outside the country. It was Obama who orchestrated 7 simultaneous wars. It was Obama's Secretary of State that organized the coup against Haiti. It was the Democrats that upped the war spending of Trump's budget another $50 billion for a total of $750 billion. So I have no confidence whatsoever that the historic party of the Southern racist bigots, today run by Joe Biden, yesterday's segregationist, yesterday's anti-busing legislator, yesterday's criminal injustice laws that imprison millions, is going to make any fundamental difference in our society. That's the problem. We are forced to go with the lesser evil time and time again. It's amazing, Mike, if you look at Biden's appointees, he argues that he's going to have the most diverse cabinet in the history of the United States. Those are his words last week. And yet diverse means he's going to employ black generals to head up the Pentagon, and women who oversaw the Abu Ghraib torture to head up top posts in the United States government. This identity politics, using blacks and Latinos to head up top posts when their records are openly racist, warmongering, and sexist bigotry, doesn't cut it with me. That's why, with regard to the manifesto that we wrote, that Alice Walker and others signed, we try to carve out some independent notion that the future of the black liberation movement was not in the Democratic Party, but was in independent organizations of the oppressed in the streets, coalescing into perhaps a black political party or a political force, an independent political force on the local level, where blacks could begin to control financially, economically, and politically their own communities, set their own agendas. The Democratic Party ended that tragically, and the struggle to rebuild it is before us.
Jeff Mackler, you've written that what we need is a new independent political party. What would that look like, and how can we get there? It seems to me that the Democratic and Republican Party are really part of the system, that they've set it up so that we can't get out from under that problem. What's needed to do to get out from under it?
Well, we saw the beginnings of this process, Mike, with 21 million people in the street and independent. That shocked the nation, if not the world. The demonstrations for Black Lives Matter were international. People were holding up signs that Black Lives Matter in every country in the world. They were inspired by the independent movement. And that was a movement in the street that gave confidence to the participants that they were no longer, or they were really not, a minority. They were not an isolated group of victims, but rather a group with a potential force. How to capture that force, it seems, requires a beginning of a group of people, a serious group of people, coming from the Black Lives Matter movement, who seek to organize an independent movement in the communities of the oppressed. We used to call it community control, but in the olden days, it better black and Puerto Rican or black and Latino control of their own communities. That was the kind of idea that Malcolm raised, and he died for it. He formed an independent organization, the Organization of African American Unity. That was the type of organization that was implied when Black Lives Matter activists came and organized mass protests in the millions. CNN reported those protests had the support of 84% of the entire population. That is when people went out in the streets in unprecedented millions in 2,000-plus cities, the American people saw that the struggle for black rights and black equality and against racism was not in the hands of a tiny minority, but was in the hearts and minds of tens of millions of people. Everybody supported the tearing down, either by the government or public officials or by the people, of these statues that were honoring the racist bigots in the Southern slaveocracy, the cessationist slaveocracy. They came down in minutes because they were symbols of a past that is really the present. And the powers that be wanted to try to at least, in the public eye, camouflage that past by taking down those symbols of racism. But the institutional racism, which exists in the day-to-day lives of the oppressed people of this country, can't be disappeared by taking down a statue. It requires fundamental change, and that, in my view, is only historically a product of mass social movements. The labor movement exists today, however weak, because our forefathers and mothers organized massive strikes, independent unions, a CIO that broke with the status quo and met the interests of working people. The same thing with every social movement. Every civil rights gain, every gain for women, came as a product not because of the largesse of those in power, but because of the mass power in the streets. When people take to the streets, they begin to realize, like they did in the summer, that they are the majority, that what they've been told all their lives, that they have no power, that they can't change City Hall, is not true. How to organize that, however, is another kettle of fish. We need an independent organization of the oppressed. That's what Malcolm tried to do. Even Dr. King, when he began to collaborate, understood with Malcolm X, began to understand that it was the system that was the problem. He did not reach the point of a break. He was murdered beforehand. That's the worst fear on the part of the ruling rich, that the millions of its victims will organize independently of the party of the multi-billionaires. The Democrats are the billionaires' party. Biden had $131 billionaires on his side, where poor Donald Trump, if I may use the expression, had nothing but 93. The majority of generals who signed New York Times ads and national security advisors signed on for Biden and Harris, not Trump. They didn't need an open racist bigot. They needed someone with more subtlety, a bit more grace, so to speak. And that's why they took the former segregationist Joe Biden and made him president of the United States. But Biden is incapable of changing the deeply rooted institutional forms of racism that plague the oppressed in every measure, whether it be health care or police brutality or mass imprisonment or deaths or jobs. By every measure, the poorest of the poor suffer the brunt of the hate and racism promulgated by the ruling rich in every aspect of our lives. We're told that the poor are violent, that the poor are aimless, that the poor want to be on welfare, that the poor don't want to work, and all the other racist notions that are refuted every single day that people are in the streets saying, no, we do want jobs, we do want to work, we do want a quality of life, we do want fine schools, but we're denied them. When there are cutbacks, they don't come to the military. They don't come to the billionaires who get bailed out to the tune of trillions, like the CARES Act. The cuts are from the poorest of the poor, and the rich have their pockets filled daily with quantitative easing from government officials that pump billions into failing corporate industries to keep them afloat at the expense of the needs of poor people.
Jeff Mackler, you've written that the Obama Biden administration laid the basis for Trump. I wanted to ask you why you think that, and also, do you think that the Biden-Harris administration will lay the basis for an even stronger far-right movement in America?
Well, we live in a time of terrible crises, and the crisis that we saw under the Obama administration was unprecedented. Obama bailed out the U.S. ruling class to the tune of unprecedented trillions. Their system wasn't working. I remember writing an article portraying a meeting that supposedly never happened of the richest billionaires on earth sitting around a mahogany table in Washington, D.C., coming up with a bailout figure of $800 billion. They literally did have that meeting. The New York Times featured a picture, and the Treasury Secretary and Ben Bernanke, the head of the Federal Reserve, marched into the White House and stopped by George Bush's office and said to George that the country, if it didn't pass this $800 billion bailout, was going to fail. And Bush's response was, why didn't anybody tell me? The same economic team walked into Congress, and within a matter of days, an unprecedented $1 trillion was used to bail out the rich. The result was millions of people, especially poor people, lost their houses. Their mortgages were closed. They couldn't pay their rent. Their jobs were terminated. And the government, at the same time, bailed out the multi-billion-dollar auto industry, General Motors. And the provisions of that bailout included the gutting of the pension system of the UAW workers. In every measure, the transfer of wealth from the rich, from the poor to the rich, from the government to the rich, was unprecedented under the Obama administration. Obama, the great liberal, deported 3 million people. Obama spent more money on war than any president in history. Obama conducted 7 simultaneous wars. That is, racist wars over oil, demonizing the people of the Middle East as terrorists, while U.S. troops took over one country after another and imposed regimes that ended up sitting on the oil resources of the richest oil region on earth. So yes, Obama set the pace, set the scale for the bailouts today, which are 6 times greater than he contemplated, which gives you an idea of the measure of the crisis. We face multiple crises that are unprecedented, that are bipartisan. I'm talking the pandemic, for example. Unbelievable. All 50 governors in every single state ordered workers back to work, only to find out today that we have the that plague operating at an unprecedented intensity in world history. 15 million people have been afflicted. Almost 300,000 are died, and the death rate is 3,000 per day. That's a bipartisan policy. The rich had to choose between having their wage slaves go back to work and grease the wheels of profit for them, or allow people to isolate with no worries about eviction, about mortgages, about foreclosures, about rent, or about food. In a civilized society, when a catastrophe of the present order takes place, any serious government begins with the lives of the people. And here, the lives of the people were subordinate to the profits of the rich. The same thing with the war economy. We have simultaneously wars everywhere. In 170 countries, the United States has 1,100 military bases. The same thing with the unemployment. It's plagued with a focus on the poorest of the poor, the service workers, the healthcare workers, the workers who do the job of growing food, who cut the meat. They are the poorest of the poor, the immigrants, and they suffer. So we have a climate crisis today that is taking the lives and threatens to literally obliterate life on Earth as we know it in our lifetime. Climate change, massive heat waves, hurricanes that devastate, crops destroyed in the millions, infestation of insects because of the temperature changes, obliteration of entire species and life-sustaining coral reefs, not to mention the inundation of the oceans themselves of land masses that drive tens of millions of people out of their homes. Every one of these crises is inherent in the capitalist system, and Biden has no solution other than more of the same. More racism, more police, more repression, more arms, more tens of billions for armaments, more wars, more poverty, more sexism, and less rights for working people. That's why the tens of millions in the streets, up to 21 million this past summer, was such an inspiration. It shows the potential that working people have when they organize, when they unite. And I have to say, the scene of tens of millions of white youth in the streets side by side with their black sisters and brothers was inspiring to everyone. That's the future, and that future is not far away.
Jeff Mackler, unfortunately, we're running out of our allotted time, but before I have to let you go, could you tell our listening audience how people can be in touch with you and connected to the kind of ideas that you've been espousing?
Well, you might know that I ran for president of the United States, and I lost the election to Trump and Biden. I'm Jeff Mackler, and I can be reached at socialistaction.org or socialistaction@lmi.net. We have a regular newspaper and activists around the country that are engaged in every struggle in humanity's interests. Get in touch with us, learn about us, receive our literature. Thanks, Jeff Mackler, socialistaction.org, socialistaction@lmi.net.
Jeff Mackler, a pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder. Thank you very much, and you take it easy.
Thanks, Mike.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Dozens of legal organizations representing more than 500,000 attorneys, along with more than 200 individual lawyers, submitted a judicial complaint against Senior U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York, Judge Louis A. Kaplan. The violations were directed at human rights lawyer Stephen Donziger, whose case we've been following on Law and Disorder. Listeners will recall that Donziger won a historic judgment against the Chevron Corporation in Ecuador to clean up the pollution caused by decades of oil drilling there with no environmental controls. The complaint was filed by the National Lawyers Guild and the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. The Chief Judge of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, Robert Katzman, has a duty to read the complaint and determine if he will appoint a committee to investigate and issue findings. The complaint documents a pattern of ethics violations committed by Judge Kaplan, a former tobacco industry lawyer. Kaplan has denied Donziger a jury trial and put in place a series of unusual courtroom tactics that severely restrict the human rights attorney's ability to mount a defense. As well, Kaplan has detained Donziger at home for more than 1 year on contempt charges. Kaplan allowed Donziger to be prosecuted by a private law firm that has Chevron as a client, and he fined the human rights lawyer $3.4 million in contempt fees, setting a record in the United States. The complaint against Kaplan alleges that, quote, the statements and actions of Judge Kaplan over the last 10 years show him to have taken on the role of counsel for Chevron rather than that of a judge adjudicating a live controversy before him. Despite accepting jurisdiction in Ecuador, Chevron came back to the United States and filed a civil racketeering or RICO case against Donziger and all of the 47 named plaintiffs. They potentially sought $60 billion in damages, the highest personal liability in U.S. history. Judge Kaplan denied Donziger a jury and let Chevron pay a witness at least $2 million while moving him and his entire family from Ecuador to the U.S. Chevron lawyers coached the witness, Alberto Guerra, for 53 days before Kaplan let him testify against Donziger. But Guerra later admitted under oath that he had lied on the stand. Another violation was Kaplan's refusing to let Donziger testify on direct examination. 29 Nobel laureates and several human rights organizations have criticized the harassment of Donziger by judicial authorities and have demanded his immediate release. Joining us today is Lauren Reagan, a member of Stephen Donziger's defense team. She is also executive director of the Oregon-based Civil Liberties Defense Center and a member of the National Lawyers Guild. Lauren, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi.
Lauren, in 2011, attorney Stephen Donziger helped indigenous peoples in Ecuador win a $9.5 billion environmental judgment against Chevron Corporation. You have a background in environmental law. What was the significance of this case?
Yeah, when they first won this case on behalf of 30,000 Ecuadorian people living in the Amazon, it was actually closer to $19 billion. And this was one of the landmark environmental justice cases that were brought on behalf of indigenous people against the fossil fuel industry for, you know, what we all know is rampant pollution, cancers, birth defects, not to mention just the destruction of the drinking water sources and the land itself. We know that there is a long legacy of fossil fuel industries going into places where they believe that the people have, little power to fight them off or to try to hold them accountable. And so to have a legal team that was made up of both Ecuadorians and American environmental and human rights lawyers was really significant. And this judgment was really going to create excellent precedent for holding the fossil fuel corporations like Chevron and Exxon and and others accountable for the devastation that they've wrought around the world. And so it wasn't necessarily surprising that Chevron was going to do anything in its enormous powers to try to deter future lawsuits of this kind from being filed at other locations and even against other fossil fuel companies as well. But I don't think anyone ever imagined that Chevron would go to the lengths and to the extent that they have gone to in order to not only attack Stephen as one of the attorneys on the team, but I think almost more importantly, the extent that they've gone to in going after him in the legal system is really meant to be chilling to other lawyers and other potential litigants. And I think the graver threat right now with regard to this case is that they are basically saying to plaintiff's lawyers, to environmental lawyers, and to potential litigants, if you dare to hold us accountable in the legal system, this is what will happen to you individually if you do so. And I think that's the primary reason why I felt it was so important to get involved in the case pro bono, is because, as someone that's done environmental law and, goes after the fossil fuel companies on behalf of activists, I think I and many other environmental lawyers saw this as an incredibly dangerous case, but for minor differences, we could be in that target zone ourselves.
How did you come to be a member of the Donziger legal team?
They reached out to me based on the work that I've done on necessity defenses for environmental and climate defenders around the country. And I also am the chair of the legal working group of the Protect the Protest Coalition, which is a coalition of nonprofits and lawyers that specifically focus on defending activists and organizations against SLAPP suits, SLAPP standing for strategic lawsuits against public participation. And we view Stephen's situation, the multiple lawsuits brought by Chevron, and even the criminal contempt case that we're currently focusing on, this is basically a SLAPP suit on steroids. You know, this is sort of the worst case scenario when a massively powerful, rich corporation basically vows to destroy its adversary. And so we felt, you know, it was also just incredibly important to stand in solidarity with him, you know, from that vantage point as well.
This case is really the perfect storm if you were teaching an ethics course in law school. It has it all. How would you present Stephen's case to law students who may be more naive than long-term practitioners?
First of all, we need to remember the importance of the right to a jury trial and the right to have impartial fact finders within the legal system. And at the very beginning, when Chevron filed this racketeering case against Stephen, one of the first moves that Chevron and the court made was to remove the right of a jury trial. And then I think the second important thing is that there is incredible value in the appearance of impartiality and the importance of the judges not appearing to have bias toward one party or the other. And especially in the Trump regime, this is going to become more and more problematic, I think. But in this case, the original judge, Judge Kaplan, you know, he is a former tobacco industry defense lawyer. You know, he went up against plaintiffs, public interest lawyers his entire career and had quite a bit of animosity for them. And throughout the RICO proceedings, he made statements basically illustrating his bias toward Chevron, talking about how important Chevron was to the economy and other things like that, just really signaling that he had picked sides in this matter. And that consistently played out throughout the RICO case, including, you know, what I think is generally most interesting to most lawyers and law students. It's been funny to see the number of lawyers that just didn't even know that this was possible. But basically, Judge Kaplan at one point, you know, Chevron demanded Stephen Donziger's computers, passwords, cell phones, and other attorney-client privileged documents. And of course, Stephen refused to provide those to Chevron. You know, they're his adversary. The computers contain legal strategy. It contained very vulnerable people living in the Amazon who cooperated and participated in different ways with the litigation over the course of a decade, many of whom did not want their names revealed to Chevron for fear of all sorts of different kinds of retaliation. And so he refused. And then Judge Kaplan basically ordered Stephen to turn over all of these things. It was really, really clear throughout the entirety of the proceedings that he had incredible scorn and disdain for Stephen in a way that I don't think many lawyers have ever actually witnessed, but he ordered Stephen to turn the devices over. And the normal way that a lawyer challenges a discovery order that they feel is incorrect under the law is that the lawyer says, you know, Your Honor, hold me in civil contempt of court. I invite you to find me in civil contempt of this order so that I can appeal it to the Court of Appeals and get a second opinion, basically. And in the meantime, the lawyer does not have to hand over the materials, because to do so, you know, would be letting the genie out of the bottle. There's not a way to put it back in. You know, the damage is done. And so under all normal circumstances, Stephen did exactly what you would expect a lawyer to do. He invited the civil contempt. Judge Kaplan found him in civil contempt, and then he immediately appealed to the Second Circuit with, you know, of the civil contempt ruling. And then Judge Kaplan did something extremely rare and really unprecedented. He drafted criminal contempt charges while the civil contempt was still pending appeal. And he walked those charges over to the U.S. Attorney's Office and basically said, you know, I want you to prosecute Stephen Donziger for criminal contempt. And to the U.S. Attorney's credit, they refused to file the charges. And that should have been the end of it. But then Judge Kaplan did something even more outrageous. He then appointed a prosecutor. He appointed a private law firm called Seward and Kissel to act as the U.S. attorney. And not only did he appoint a private law firm, but then later on we uncovered that that private law firm had Chevron as a client as recently as 2018. And we even had ethics experts file declarations saying that that law firm had an unequivocal conflict, and especially with regard to criminal prosecutions, that there should never be even just the appearance of bias, let alone bias. And here is a private white shoe law firm that profits and makes tons of legal fees, not only off of Chevron, but Chevron affiliates, entities that work closely in that industry and with Chevron. Now that firm steps into the shoes of the U.S. Attorney's Office and gets to prosecute him. And then Judge Kaplan appointed the judge. Rather than using the traditional random assignment for federal judges, he handpicks Judge Loretta Preska to preside over the criminal contempt. But he doesn't take himself off the case either. And so Judge Kaplan basically is standing behind Judge Preska, whispering in her ear, and basically assisting in her conducting the case. She's supposed to be this neutral second look, you know, this criminal contempt judge, but instead, her role, in my opinion, is basically to keep the machinations that Judge Kaplan created in play. You know, her job is to basically finish what Judge Kaplan began. And, you know, from the minute that that criminal case was filed, we knew that it was not business as usual. You know, for instance, you know, not only do we now have a private law firm representing Chevron getting to be the prosecutor of him again, and we have this handpicked judge presiding over the matter, but when Stephen shows up for his arraignment on this criminal contempt charge, he ends up having to post an $800,000 bond, and he is ordered into home detention. He has to wear an ankle bracelet, a GPS monitoring device, 24 hours a day. He had to surrender his passport, and they threatened his bar license right off the bat. And in fact, for over a year, Stephen has been in home detention with that ankle bracelet, unable to leave his apartment without permission for like court appearances or medical appointments, based on this minor criminal contempt charge. In fact, subsequently, Judge Preska was forced to acknowledge that the maximum punishment available on this charge is 6 months. And from our research around the country, the most severe sentence that has ever been handed down in a federal court against a lawyer for criminal contempt was 90 days of house arrest. Stephen has spent more than four times that already on home detention without even being convicted of any charges.
Lauren, I have to stop you here. You remind me of several things. One is the so-called Mumia exception in Mumia Abu-Jamal's case, where the law simply doesn't apply to him in the Pennsylvania courts. This sounds like the Donziger exception. And in terms of the RICO charges, we know those are notoriously hard to defend against. We saw in New York City, for example, housing project gang arrests of teenagers who knew one another in tight communities. RICO was invoked, and it was hard for the kids to find competent defense attorneys. And then Donziger was fined $3.4 million in contempt fees. Finally, our listeners know of Judge Loretta Preska because she sentenced our hacker friend Jeremy Hammond to 10 years in prison, even though she had a conflict of interest in that case because her husband had been a client of Stratfor, one of the companies that was hacked, and she refused to recuse herself.
Yeah, it was $200,000 a day, and that is in addition to the $60 billion request for judgment that Chevron made against him for that RICO case.
Lauren, I want to ask you about the media blackout in this case. Have you seen this in other political cases where, for example, the media is just not covering Stephen's story?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the media is afraid of Chevron. You know, when they see a corporation like this going after a lawyer, that is one of the most chilling targets that can be picked because very often, whether it's activists or journalists, when corporations like Chevron start going after the lawyers who represent people in court using the legal means that are available, you know, when they become targets, everyone else becomes very afraid. You know, I think there's like overwhelming experience, you know, historically, that when lawyers are targeted, everybody else begins to bite their fingernails.
How can our listeners learn more or get involved in helping Stephen?
Well, our website is cldc.org, which stands for Civil Liberties Defense Center.org. And we've got a bunch of information and ways that you can plug in there. I believe there is a website called Make Chevron Clean Up, where you can find more information about the case and to support Stephen as well. And I know he's pretty prolific on Twitter as well, if your listeners are Twitter users.
Yes, we'll be sure to put a link to Stephen's Twitter on our website. Lauren Regan, you are a wonderful addition to Stephen's legal team. We would love to have you back on the show to talk about your other political defense work. And we will be waiting with bated breath to hear what happens in court next week. Thank you for your fine work on this and in so many other areas.
Thank you, Heidi. Take care.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.